You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Our show features our team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. And they'll help you make the most of your money while cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. You'll get clarity on strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey everyone, thanks for tuning in to episode 440 of our Civil War podcast. I'm Rich.
And I'm Tracy. Hello y'all, welcome to the podcast. As y'all will recall, with the last episode, we looked at the clashes at Rappahannock Station and at Kelly's Ford on November 7th, 1863, after George Meade moved the Army of the Potomac forward, seeking to come to grips with Robert E. Lee and the Army of Northern Virginia.
Yep, exactly. And if you ever want to see how political pressure influenced a Civil War military campaign, then Meade's movement here in November 1863 is a great example. Because, as we said last time, Meade's preference would have been to put the Army of the Potomac into winter quarters and say the campaigning season was over. But he received a direct order from Abraham Lincoln by way of General-in-Chief Henry Halleck to, quote-unquote, attack Lee's army.
Well, there was no arguing with such an order, so Meade prepared to open up a new campaign designed to crack the rebels' Rappahannock River line and then get a battle out of Lee somewhere in the countryside beyond the river.
On November 7th, the Federals scored successes at both Rappahannock Station and at Kelly's Ford, forcing Lee to abandon his position behind the river and withdraw to the southwest, where the Confederates took up a new line in the countryside between Brandy Station and Culpeper. This was just the situation Meade was hoping for. But before he could come to grips with the rebels, Lee decided to pull back again.
Lee was pulling back again because, upon reflection, he'd realized that his left flank, which was up in the air, was vulnerable to being turned. This time he pulled the army back below the Rapidan, where, once safely below the river, most of the Confederate soldiers found themselves occupying the same camps they'd been in before stepping off on the Bristoe Station campaign the previous month.
As a new day dawned on the morning of November 9th, Meade discovered Lee had pulled back below the Rapidan. And any delight Meade may have enjoyed over the successes at Rappahannock Station and Kelly's Ford was quickly snuffed out when telegrams from Washington started to arrive, expressing displeasure that he hadn't pressed forward aggressively enough to catch Lee before he pulled back behind the Rapidan.
George Meade pondered his options. The weather had taken a turn for the worse on the 8th, and if Meade had his druthers, he'd now go into winter quarters. But with Washington once more breathing down his neck, that might not be possible. Knowing the decision wasn't his to make, Meade wired Halleck and Secretary of War Edwin Stanton on November 13th, asking for a meeting.
George Meade went to Washington the next day. He said and wrote little about that visit to the Capitol, but he obviously didn't receive permission to go into winter quarters, because after his return to the Army, he began to plan another forward movement, this one across the Rapidan.
With the Confederates now spread thin across a 20-mile front, Meade planned to cross the Rapidan at several lower fords and use the Orange Plank Road and Orange Turnpike to get behind Lee's right flank.
Those names might ring a bell for some of you, since the Orange Plank Road and Orange Turnpike featured prominently in our coverage of the Battle of Chancellorsville, which took place in the Wilderness, that region of extremely rough country west of Fredericksburg, where in May 1863, Robert E. Lee won a spectacular victory over the Army of the Potomac, then commanded by Joe Hooker.
Here, in November 1863, the area we're talking about was on the western edge of the Wilderness. In fact, after crossing the Rapidan, some of the Yankees will march past Old Wilderness Tavern there on the Orange Turnpike.
George Meade's plan to cross the Rapidan at several of the river's lower fords and get behind Lee's right flank was a good one. After swiftly crossing the river and quickly swinging west across a little creek known as Mine Run, Meade envisioned either 1. Crushing a part of the rebel army before Lee could respond, or 2. Having the Army of the Potomac stand on the defensive on the high ground west of Mine Run, where Lee would almost certainly attack it, and where the Federals could make the Confederates pay dearly for assaulting such a strong position. Meade's chief of staff, Major General Andrew Humphreys, later wrote, quote, "The plan promised brilliant success. To ensure it required prompt, vigorous action and intelligent compliance with the program on the part of the Corps and other subordinate commanders."
However, unfortunately for Meade, while his plan called for prompt, vigorous action and intelligent compliance with the program by his lieutenants, those key elements would be missing in action as the Army moved forward across the Rapidan.
The first wrench that was thrown into George Meade's plan came courtesy of Mother Nature. Heavy rains soaked the area on November 20th and 21st, raising the level of the Rapidan and turning the roads into ribbons of mud. However, a bright sun dawned on the 22nd, and Meade met with his corps commanders that evening to issue them final orders. He emphasized the need for swift marches by each of the 3 columns that would strike across the river.
Gouverneur Warren's 2nd Corps would cross at Germanna Ford and march for Robertson's Tavern on the Orange Turnpike, about 4 miles southeast of the Confederate right flank.
Once there, Warren would rendezvous with William French's 3rd Corps, which would cross the Rapidan at Jacobs Ford, about 3.5 miles upstream from Germanna. French's route to link up with the right flank of 2nd Corps was only about 7 miles, but it was along narrow country roads and through large stretches of dense wilderness.
John Sedgwick's Big 6th Corps would follow French's 3rd Corps across the river at Jacobs Ford.
Meanwhile, George Sykes' 5th Corps would cross the Rapidan at Culpeper Mine Ford, about 4.5 miles downriver from Germanna Ford, and then head for Parker's Store and New Hope Church on the Orange Plank Road, with John Newton's 1st Corps marching behind it.
However, once 1st Corps reached Parker's Store, Newton would strike off to the northwest toward Locust Grove to plug the gap between the left of 3rd Corps and the right of 5th Corps.
Well, as you can tell from all of that, Meade's plan was not only ambitious, but it had a lot of moving parts. And in an area like the Wilderness, where communication between the separate columns and different corps commanders would be problematic, there was the risk Meade's plan would run off the rails simply because it would be difficult to coordinate the many moving parts of his plan.
With the corps commanders issued their final orders and the men ready to march, the movement was set to begin at first light on November 24th. However, just as the troops were breaking camp, it began to rain again. The heavy rain made the Rapidan unfordable and further worsened the condition of the already muddy roads. As a result, Meade postponed the start time for the movement until 6 a.m. on the morning of the 26th.
The The second wrench that was thrown into Meade's plan came courtesy of Third Corps Commander William French. If we backtrack a bit, we'd find that after the Battle of Gettysburg, George Meade's options were limited as far as filling the voids in the Army of the Potomac's command structure. His two biggest losses at Gettysburg came at the top of First Corps and Second Corps, with the death of John Reynolds and the serious wound suffered by Winfield Scott Hancock.
To replace the fallen Reynolds, Meade turned to Major General John Newton and gave him command of First Corps. Meanwhile, as Hancock recuperated, Meade handed the reins of Second Corps to Major General Gouverneur K. Warren, the Army's chief engineer and one of the heroes of the second day's fighting at Gettysburg at Little Round Top.
Newton and Warren proved to be mostly reliable replacements, but Meade would regret his decision to give Third Corps to Major General William French. The 48-year-old French had missed the Battle of Gettysburg because he was in command of the garrison at Harper's Ferry. In the aftermath of Gettysburg, after rejoining the Army of the Potomac, French's seniority put him in line for command of a corps, and he replaced the wounded Dan Sickles at the top of Third Corps.
French, a West Point graduate and Mexican War veteran, had led a brigade at the Battle of Fair Oaks and the Seven Days Battles, and then was given command of a division in Second Corps. His men were at the center of the fighting at Antietam, losing over 1,700 casualties around the Roulette Farm and the Bloody Lane. He was promoted to Major General in November 1862 and led his division in the futile Federal attacks against Marye's Heights at Fredericksburg.
Some of you may recall that William French is tied to Stonewall Jackson because of an ugly episode that took place between the two men after the Mexican War, when French was the commanding officer of an army fort in Florida and the future Stonewall was one of his subordinates. Well, Jackson leveled some unsavory charges against French, leading to a bitter spat between the two officers. His nasty quarrel with French led to Jackson leaving the army when he accepted a teaching position at the Virginia Military Institute.
Here, on the morning of November 26, the Federal crossings at Germanna and Culpeper Mine Fords went smoothly. But at Jacobs Ford, Sedgwick's Sixth Corps found its path to the river blocked by French's Third Corps, which was unprepared to move, despite Meade's strict orders that speed was essential.
Meade was forced to order the other two columns to wait for French. When French finally got moving and Third Corps reached the Rapidan at noon, he halted again to deal with an unfounded report that the rebels were in force on the other side. Then, the pontoon bridge being laid across the river came up short, delaying French another 2 hours.
Once across the Rapidan, French promptly headed down the wrong road, and by the time that mistake was corrected, Meade's plan was hopelessly behind schedule.
Thanks to French's fumbling, instead of a speedy advance across the river on the 26th, and then a quick push west the next day to reach Mine Run, Meade, by the morning of the 27th, didn't even have his entire army across the Rapidan.
As the Yankees crossed the Rapidan at those three fords, Robert E. Lee remained uncertain whether his army or the Confederate capital of Richmond was Meade's target. As Lee put his army in motion and moved Dick Ewell's and A.P. Hill's troops eastward to develop the situation, contact was made with the Federals and heavy skirmishing broke out between the two armies on November 27th.
And remember, when speaking of Lee's army, well, the infantry that is, we're still just talking about Ewell's Corps and Hill's Corps because James Longstreet is in Tennessee. In fact, at this point, on November 27th, Longstreet is just 2 days away from launching his ill-fated assault on Fort Sanders at Knoxville. Well, in any case, here, as a major battle seemed imminent, Lee's army numbered about 56,000 men, while the Army of the Potomac's reports on November 20th showed its strength to be just over 95,850 men.
So the delay the previous day meant George Meade may have lost the element of surprise, but he still had the advantage of superior numbers. He issued orders for the various corps to be on the move by 7 a.m. on the morning of Friday, the 27th.
With the various corps, there were necessarily a lot of moving parts to his plan, as we mentioned. But Meade's orders for the 27th were straightforward. Once in motion, the corps would head south and then west through the wilderness toward Mine Run on several roads, namely the Orange Plank Road, the Orange Turnpike, and the Raccoon Ford Road. So Meade's orders were straightforward. The only question was whether the Federal Corps commanders could successfully execute them, and whether Robert E. Lee would let them.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for the New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
As you would expect, with the dense woods and underbrush of the wilderness creating claustrophobic conditions and restricting movement to the roads that cut through the tangled landscape, and with both armies using those same several roads to approach each other, well, once contact was made between the Confederates and Federals, there was little that could be done in the way of maneuvering to gain an advantage.
Instead, it was more like two rams butting heads as the Federals, heading west, and the rebels, heading east, ran into each other while moving along the Orange Plank Road, the Orange Turnpike, and the Raccoon Ford Road.
To the south, along the Orange Plank Road, on the Federal left, the Yankees, in the form of David McMurtry Gregg's Cavalry Division and 5th Corps, ran into rebel cavalry led by Wade Hampton and Confederate infantry from Hill's Corps. This led to fighting around New Hope Church.
In the center, along the Orange Turnpike, the Federal infantry from 2nd Corps ran into Confederate infantry from Ewell's Corps, and this led to fighting around Robertson's Tavern. And by the by, Ewell's Corps was actually being led here by Jubal Early, since Dick Ewell was absent from the army at this time because he was sick and because his amputated leg was giving him problems.
And then to the north, nearest the Rapidan on the Federal right, were French's Third Corps and, behind it, Sedgwick's Sixth Corps. Here on the 27th, French had another poor showing.
That's because French misunderstood Meade's orders. So, after moving only a short distance down the Jacobs Ford Road, he halted to wait for Warren's Second Corps, which he thought would be moving toward him. When Meade learned of this, he was furious and shot back a message to French saying Third Corps shouldn't have halted, but ought to be moving forward as rapidly as possible to link up with Second Corps. Well, the four remaining miles French still needed to cover were through the tangled landscape that was typical of the wilderness, which meant movement was severely restricted, and he had to leave his lead division up front rather than swap it out for another unit. Unfortunately, the lead 3rd Corps division was led by French's most incompetent division commander, Henry Prince.
When Prince reached a fork in the road, he didn't know which route he should take. Unable to decide, Prince wasted more than 2 hours trying to decide which road to take. French was only a short distance back the column, only about 300 yards away, but incredibly, instead of simply riding forward to get things moving, he used couriers to communicate back and forth with Prince about the situation.
When French sent an update to Meade about Third Corps' progress, or lack of it, and saying that now there were reports a large enemy force was approaching his right on the Raccoon Ford Road, George Meade blew his top. By this time it was around 2 p.m., and according to a staff officer, when he received French's report, Meade, quote, became greatly out of temper about it.
To Meade, the news that a large force of Confederates was approaching on the Raccoon Ford Road seemed to indicate that Lee was likely making a move to strike the Federals' right, while other rebel forces kept Meade's center and left occupied.
And so, it's no wonder a frustrated George Meade exploded in anger that afternoon. French's failure to move rapidly and link up with Warren's Second Corps, as ordered, now raised the possibility that the entire Army of the Potomac was in real danger, because if Lee was, in fact, mounting a strong effort against the Federal right, then Warren could be turned or crushed, and French cut off and destroyed, while Sedgwick's Sixth Corps was still jammed up behind him.
Fortunately for George Meade, the Confederates coming down the Raccoon Ford Road, approaching his right, weren't a sign that Lee was making a major push against the exposed Federal flank. Luckily for Meade, those rebels, in fact, were instead just one part of Lee pushing his army to the east to make contact with the Yankees and develop the situation.
In fact, of the three Confederate columns pushing east along the Orange Plank Road, the Orange Turnpike, and the Raccoon Ford Road, the one to the north, approaching the Federal right on the Raccoon Ford Road, was the weakest of the three, since it consisted of only one division. To be precise, Edward Allegheny Johnson's division of Ewell's Corps.
However, since Meade didn't know it was just one Confederate division, when he received French's report that afternoon saying that Third Corps was halted again and that a large force of Confederates was approaching on the Raccoon Ford Road, Meade replied that French should, quote, attack the enemy in your front immediately, throwing your left forward so as to connect with General Warren at Robertson's Tavern. The object of the attack is to form a junction with General Warren, which must be effected immediately.
When William French attempted to carry out those orders from Meade, the result was a sometimes heavy but generally confused action with Allegheny Johnson's Confederates at a place called Payne's Farm, which was just a couple of farmsteads that had been carved out of the surrounding heavy woods and choking underbrush. Of the three sets of fights that developed between the two armies on the 27th, at Parker's Store and New Hope Church to the south on the Orange Plank Road, at Robertson's Tavern in the center on the Orange Turnpike, and at Payne's Farm to the north, the clash at Payne's Farm resulted in the heaviest combat. By the time darkness brought an end to the fighting, the clash at Payne's Farm had resulted in about 500 Confederate casualties, while the Federals lost around 950 men.
By the end of the day on November 27th, George Meade was frustrated and disappointed. What he had envisioned as a swift crossing of the Rapidan, followed by a rapid move to get behind Lee's right flank, had turned into sloppy marching and three disjointed, inconclusive fights.
As for Robert E. Lee, he now had an answer to his question about whether his army, or Richmond, was the Federal target. It was now obvious Meade's target was the Confederate army. That being the case, and since the current disposition of his forces wasn't optimal for defensive purposes, Lee decided to issue orders that would pull Hill's and Early's divisions back to the higher terrain west of Mine Run.
And so, that night, despite a cold rain, the Confederates withdrew to the west and, once behind Mine Run, immediately started to erect breastworks to improve their positions. According to a captain in the 12th Alabama, quote, "It is marvelous with what rapidity a fortification sufficiently strong to resist many balls can be thrown up. A sense of danger quickens a man's energies."
George Meade had the Army of the Potomac press forward again at first light on November 28th, fully expecting the movement to trigger sharp fighting. But, except for some Confederate pickets, it seemed the enemy had disappeared.
A steady cold rain poured down, hindering the Federals' ability to determine where exactly the Confederates had gone. But Meade suspected they'd simply pulled back to the west.
The Yankee soldiers battled the miserable conditions as they probed west down the roads toward Mine Run. According to an officer on Meade's staff, quote, "It was a tremendous job in the narrow roads, through the woods, deep with mud, and it occupied fully the whole day."
When the Federals arrived at Mine Run on the western edge of the wilderness, their already low spirits fell even further when they saw that all across their front, on the high ground behind the creek, the rebels were hunkered down in an entrenched position stronger than any the Yankee soldiers had ever seen. George Meade described the enemy position as, quote, "extremely formidable."
A.P. Hill's men held the right side of the Confederate position, while Early's troops manned the left. The rebels continued to toil throughout the day on the 28th, seeking to make their already strong line impregnable. Across the way, the Federal soldiers scanned the enemy works, dreading the thought they would be ordered to attack them. But the more Meade saw of the Confederate position, the more he realized it would be nothing short of foolish to attack it frontally. Instead, Meade decided to adopt a plan suggested by Gouverneur Warren on the 28th. You see, Warren had scouted off to the Federal left and believed a flanking movement could be made in that direction. Warren pointed out that, if successful, such a flanking movement would threaten Lee's right and rear, quote, "with the intention of making him abandon his present front."
Once he decided to run with Warren's idea, Meade issued orders for the following day, the 29th, that would set Warren's Second Corps, along with additional troops, totaling some 18,000 men, in motion around the Confederate right flank.
Meanwhile, the men of both sides continued to suffer in the wretched weather. To add to their misery, many of the Federals had thrown away their overcoats and blankets at the start of the campaign, rather than carry those items on the march, and now they regretted it. A Yankee officer recalled, quote, "The night of November 28th, 29th was bitter cold. The north wind and cold frost made us suffer. Those who had no blankets suffered terribly. I tried to sleep with only my overcoat, not having any blanket, but soon awoke almost frozen."
when the Federal soldiers tapped to be a part of the flanking movement, started out early on the morning of the 29th, they were probably happy to be moving, since being in motion was the best way to combat the numbing cold.
The long, slow movement in the terrible conditions took most of the day, but when Warren rode to Meade's headquarters at about 8 o'clock that night, he could report that he was in a perfect position to turn Lee's right flank. Meade was so pleased with Warren's report that he decided to reinforce Warren's force by adding more troops to it. In addition, Meade decided to attack Lee's left flank also, come morning, with 5th and 6th Corps.
Meade's orders for the next day, November 30th, called for the Federal artillery to open up at 8 a.m., followed immediately by Warren's attack on the rebel right. Then Sykes' 5th Corps and Sedgwick's 6th Corps would attack the rebel left an hour later at 9 a.m.
After another miserable night, the troops under Warren's command moved into position for the attack. In a letter to his wife, Colonel Robert McAllister of the 11th New Jersey wrote, quote, "The day was so cold that the breath was freezing on the bridle bits of the horses."
McAllister said that, quote, "Many went to take a peek at the works they were to storm." This included McAllister himself, who wrote, quote, "I made up my mind that we could take it, but that it would be at a fearful loss of life, and if it should fail, it would destroy the army."
The chaplain of the 14th Connecticut recalled that the Confederates, quote, "had prepared a strong and high works of timber and earth with abatis. It was plain that they could pour upon us a heavy fire from a long distance. So confident were the rebels of success that they stood in crowds upon their works and tauntingly beckoned us to come on."
The Federal artillery opened promptly at 8 a.m. The thousands of troops under Warren's command waited for the order to begin their attack. But the minutes ticked slowly past and no order arrived. What none of them yet realized was that Warren had canceled the assault.
At first light, Gouverneur K. Warren had mounted his horse and rode out to take another look at the enemy position. He could see that the rebels had spent the night not only strengthening their position, but that Lee had extended his lines so that now, instead of hitting the Confederates' flank, Warren's attack would strike the extension of the enemy line head on.
Robert E. Lee, of course, had been aware of the Federal movement on the 29th, threatening his left, so he had indeed taken measures to protect that flank. The result was that Warren now realized any assault now on the rebel position would be little short of suicidal.
Because he was too far away from Army headquarters to consult with Meade, Warren took it upon himself to call off the attack. Meanwhile, at Army headquarters, George Meade heard the Federal artillery open fire on schedule, but the expected heavy rattle of musket fire was missing. Meade wondered what was happening on the Army's left, until about 10 to 9, one of Warren's aides rode up with a scribbled message from the Second Corps commander. It told Meade, quote, "The enemy position and strength seem so formidable in my present front that I advise against making the attack here. The full light of the sun shows me that I cannot succeed."
Hey there, I'm Dylan Lewis, one of the hosts of Motley Fool Money. Each weekday on Motley Fool Money, we talk through the business news you need to know and the stories moving stocks on Wall Street. On weekends, we dive into the industries shaping tomorrow and host the experts, authors, and executives that understand them. Tune in for insights, a long-term perspective on investing, and of course, stock ideas, plenty of them. To quote a listener, it pays to listen. Check us out and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
History never says goodbye. It just says, see you later. Edward Galliano was right when he said that. Events keep happening over and over again in some form. And that's the reason I produce the podcast, My History Can Beat Up Your Politics. What is it? We take stories of history and apply them to the events of today to help you, perhaps, understand them better. We are also part of Airwave Media Network. I've been doing the program since 2006. That's a long time, and the show has a long name. My history can beat up your politics. Find me wherever you get podcasts.
One of Meade's staff officers recalled that when Warren's message arrived at headquarters, saying he had taken it upon himself to cancel the attack on the Confederate right, it, quote, was a terrible shock to all.
Knowing that, in a matter of minutes, 5th and 6th Corps were scheduled to launch their assault on the rebel left, the same officer said that, quote, Meade instantly ordered the whole movement to be suspended, sending off his aides as fast as horse could carry them.
Those who saw him agreed Meade's anger was something to behold. The commanding general, remembered one eyewitness, was, quote, looking as savage as anyone could.
With winter weather descending upon central Virginia, George Meade knew that this was his last opportunity to gain an advantage over Lee and strike the rebel army a hard blow. So he simply had to see for himself whether the attack plans could be salvaged. Between 10 and 11 a.m., Meade rode out to the army's left. After talking to Warren and taking a look at the Confederate lines himself, Meade agreed with Warren's decision to cancel the attack on the enemy right.
That evening, Meade called his corps commanders together for a meeting at Army headquarters. After hearing Sedgwick's assessment that any assault on the enemy left would also be suicidal, Meade, the next day, December 1st, issued orders for the Army of the Potomac to pull back across the Rapidan that night.
Meanwhile, across the lines, Robert E. Lee, who, of course, wasn't privy to what was going on at Meade's headquarters, decided to launch his own attack on the Yankee Army. All Lee knew was that since the big enemy cannonade on the morning of the 30th, the Federals just seemed to be sitting on their hands across the way. And so if Meade wasn't going to attack him, Lee was going to attack Meade. Lee's preference was always to be the one striking the blows, and here at Mine Run, his mindset was no different. So he began shifting units about to be ready to launch an attack on the enemy left at first light the next day, December 2nd.
But when the Confederate attack went forward on the morning of the 2nd, all it hit was empty air. The Federals were gone.
The long and eventful campaigning season that had started with Lee's strike north back in October was finally over, and both armies would now, finally, settle into winter quarters.
Once he discovered that the Yankees had disappeared from in front of Mine Run, Robert E. Lee did launch a pursuit of the enemy, but he quickly realized Meade had successfully pulled off his withdrawal to the Rapidan and that there would be no catching up to the Federals.
The rebels went into winter quarters, with Hill's men settling in around Orange Courthouse, and Ewell's troops camped to the northeast, watching the Rapidan fords. The scarcity of supplies, especially rations, would be a constant source of worry for Lee that winter. Sometimes days passed without meat being issued to the army, and Lee would write to Jefferson Davis soon after the new year began that, quote, I fear I shall be unable to retain it, that is the army, in the field. I do not see how we can operate with our present supplies.
Another problem was the high number of desertions. This had been a problem for quite a while now, and it continued to plague the rebel army that winter. Lee dealt harshly with those captured and caught, and firing squads were common that winter. Some felt compassion for the men who had left the ranks without authorization, since many of them did so because of pressing needs back home. but most of the soldiers understood their duty and that punishment was required. One North Carolinian would write, "We are soldiers and we have to stay as long as there is any war."
While the dismal supply situation and high number of desertions sapped morale, Lee's army did experience the continuation of a religious revival that winter, which, by all accounts, helped the soldiers persevere through their trials. It's estimated that as many as 15,000 men either saw the light or recommitted themselves to the faith during the winter months. Nearly every brigade built a log chapel, and on most nights it was filled with men seeking to shore up their spirits through song and scripture.
As for the Federals, with his army safely back across the Rapidan, George Meade put the Army of the Potomac into winter camps some distance back from the river and set the Union cavalry to patrolling the no man's land between the two armies.
Although it hadn't been a particularly bloody fall campaigning season, it had been a grueling one. The armies had come close on several occasions to fighting large-scale battles that likely would have racked up fearful butcher's bills. One Federal soldier no doubt spoke for thousands of others when he wrote in a letter home, "Thank heaven that I still live." Many of the soldiers thought differently about Meade after the Mine Run campaign ended. Those who had served under him in Fifth Corps usually had few complimentary things to say about him, and many gave him only grudging credit for the victory at Gettysburg, since in the end the defeated Confederates had escaped back to Virginia. But when Meade refused to throw the lives of his men away against Lee's strongly entrenched position at Mine Run, the soldiers' respect for him grew.
A surgeon in Sixth Corps echoed the thoughts of many when he said, quote, "If Meade ever did a noble act in his life, it was when he concluded not to fight Lee."
Lieutenant Colonel Theodore Lyman, an officer on Meade's staff, agreed. Knowing well the pressure Meade had been under from Washington to get a battle out of Lee before the turn of the year, Lyman wrote, "I shall always be astonished at the extraordinary moral courage of General Meade, who had the firmness to say, 'The blow had simply failed, and we shall only add disaster to failure by persisting.'"
As for Meade himself, he would spend much of that winter away from the army, convalescing at home after he contracted a bad case of pneumonia. John Sedgwick would command the army in Meade's absence. George Meade wouldn't be well enough to return to the army until February 1864.
By then, momentous events were just around the corner, as in March, Ulysses S. Grant was promoted to lieutenant general and elevated to general-in-chief of all the Union armies. Grant would come east and accompany Meade and the Army of the Potomac when the spring 1864 campaigning season opened. And also in March 1864, the War Department reorganized the Army of the Potomac. As you guys will recall, 11th and 12th Corps had been detached and sent west to serve at Chattanooga. Now, 1st Corps and 3rd Corps, which were mere shadows of their former selves due to casualties, sickness, and discharges, were broken up and their men and units parceled out to 2nd, 5th, and 6th Corps. The veterans of 1st and 3rd Corps were allowed to keep their distinctive corps badges, but none of them were happy with the change. Well, okay. We're getting into stuff that was happening in 1864, so we're getting a bit ahead of ourselves. Since we said that before we turn the calendar over from 1863 to 1864 on the podcast timeline, we want to do some year-in-review episodes for 1863. So let's go ahead and start to wrap up this show, and next time we'll start our retrospective on what all went on in 1863.
That means it's time for this episode's book recommendation. And our recommendation this time is The Great Battle Never Fought, The Mine Run Campaign by Chris Makowski.
Coverage of Mine Run in book-length treatments is few and far between, but this is part of the excellent Emerging Civil War series, so it gives a solid look at what happened and what almost happened.
Don't forget, you can find a list of all of our book recommendations if you head over to the podcast website, which is www.civilwarpodcast.org.
Also at the website, you can find info on joining the Strawfoot Brigade over on Patreon and supporting the podcast in that way, just like William S., Stefan, Marcus Aurelius, and Tony B.
And Tom, Drew, Will E., Brian W., Steve S., and Michael B.
Thanks, guys. And thanks to all of you for listening to this episode of the podcast. Tracy and I do hope that you join us again next time, but until then, take care.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.